Homeless Link is the national membership charity for frontline homelessness services. We work to improve services through research, guidance and learning, and campaign for policy change that will ensure everyone has a place to call home and the support they need to keep it.
In this series of the Going Beyond podcast, we will discuss good practice in how to support individuals experiencing homelessness who have complex health and care needs. The episodes will cover dual diagnosis, physical health needs, hoarding, self-neglect, and brain injury. In each episode, we will speak to a guest who will tell us about their roles and expertise and provide practical tips for frontline staff to deliver good practice. I'm Jo Turner, National Practice Development Project Manager at Homeless Link, and I'll be your host. We hope you enjoy it. In this episode, we speak to Dr. Stephen Weatherhead, clinical psychologist specialising in brain injury and co-director of NeuroTriage, a brain injury service for people who are homeless in Liverpool. We speak about the prevalence and impact of brain injury for people experiencing homelessness and discuss how frontline workers can best support these individuals. So hi, Steve, how are you today?
Good morning. I'm doing very good, thank you. Very good.
Great to hear. So thank you so much for being here today to record for the Going Beyond podcast. So to start us off for the listeners, could you tell us a bit about yourself and the work you do?
Yeah, so I'm Steve Weatherhead. I'm a clinical psychologist. I specialise in brain injury and homelessness. Got a long personal history, but would naturally bring me into clinical psychology around struggles at home as a kid and parental mental health problems. And then gradually found my way into psychology, not really with the intention of becoming a psychologist, just looking at things that I liked to do, and ended up here. And finally, probably nearly towards the back end of my career now, working in homelessness feels like a place where I belong and can do my best.
Incredible. And it would be great to hear a bit about sort of NeuroTriage, which you set up.
Yeah, so I used to work in a community brain injury service, and I've worked in hospital-based brain injury services as well. During the, maybe 5 or 6 years I was working in those settings, I only saw one person who was homeless. And when I did meet him, it really kind of resonated, struck a chord for two reasons. One, if it weren't for luck, I'd have ended up down exactly the same path. So I really connected in that way. And secondly, I thought, where are all the other homeless people? You know, we've got a brain injury service here and I've been working here for years and this is the only person I've seen. Maybe being homeless is some kind of protective mechanism from getting a brain injury. Did a little bit of research, had a little look around and found some work done by the Disabilities Trust up in Leeds that showed that around about 45% of the homeless population had sustained a brain injury, which is a huge number, and especially when you compare that to the one person that had come in our service. And so spoke to a few people, and over a little while, myself and a few friends and an amazing was then trainee clinical psychologist called Rebecca McKenzie, set up NeuroTriage, which we initially intended to be a outreach neuro assessment service for the homeless population of Liverpool. It just got really big really quickly. It's not big in terms of us, we're still just 3 or 4 people, but big in terms of the amount of awareness that grew around brain injury and homelessness in Liverpool. Some of that to do with the people that I was working with directly through NeuroTriage. So we set up, there's myself, Rob Parker, there was Rebecca McKenzie, Hannah Iveson, Cormac Duffy, Clee Lee, a bunch of other people just coming in and out of NeuroTriage to set it up. But what we found was more than that, the services, the homeless services, support workers and people who were directly working with this population were saying to us, I'm sure there's something going on with the brain here. Can you come and have a look? And over that first year of working, I think we had about between 40 and 50 referrals, and all but one of them were accurate referrals. So what you're saying is we've got nearly 50 people who, before we started working with them, were not known to brain injury services, but did have a brain injury and did not have specialised care for that need. And then gradually we grew further then in terms of reach, because we realised that if you look beyond just traumatic brain injury and you think, what's the cognitive struggles that the homeless population experience, then the numbers were huge. And the way that we worked was meaningful in terms of working with complexity and homelessness.
Wow. So it's obvious how much your service was needed. So this series of the Going Beyond podcast, it's all about understanding the complex health and care needs that people experiencing homelessness face. So for this episode, we wanted to explore the high prevalence of brain injury in people experiencing homelessness, like you said, and how we can best support those affected. So I wanted to start by asking you, Steve, what proportion of the homeless population are affected by a brain injury, do you think?
Yeah, sure. Just before doing that, it's probably worth mentioning that we nationally have the survey of health needs in the homeless population, don't we? It'd be good if at some point we got brain injury caught within that as well, because it's a huge unmet need. So official research statistics would say that around about 45 to 55% of the homeless population have sustained a brain injury. So about half. Most of those will have sustained that brain injury before becoming homeless. So you've got about half the homeless population with a brain injury. And then if you add into that alcohol-related brain damage, so damage that's occurred to the brain as a consequence of heavy long-term alcohol use, you've got another 10 to 15% of the population on top of that. So now you're looking at 60, 65% of the homeless population with some form of brain injury. Then you add into that learning disability. A lot of the homeless population, maybe around 10 to 15% of the homeless population, have a learning disability, either diagnosed in childhood and gone to a school for children with special educational needs or had special educational needs support, or have been marginalized from education by not accessing school. So their brain's not fully developed through the educational systems that we've got. And then you've got 10 to 15% of that population as well. So now you're looking at around about 70 to 80% of the homeless population has got a cognitive impairment. That's huge numbers. You add into that then trauma, and we all know all of the homeless population have experienced trauma, many of which have experienced multiple ACEs, so adverse childhood experiences, multiple during childhood, which affects brain growth. So the way we experience life during our early years in particular and during adolescence affects the way our brain develops. The bits of the brain that we use a lot grow, the bits that we don't use so much get washed away. And so what that means, if you're experiencing trauma throughout your early years, your brain is developing into a traumatized brain. So your frontal lobes aren't reaching their full capacity and your limbic system is always fired up around fear and danger. And so the brain capacity gets shaped accordingly. So we've got then, in short, 70 to 80% of the homeless population, you've got a diagnosable neurological condition, and all of the homeless population will have some kind of cognitive struggle with their thinking skills as a consequence of other experiences in life.
Wow, that is huge.
It's huge and terrifying, and also largely unmet, which is just crazy. If we said, I don't know, if we said 80% of the homeless population had a prosthetic limb, we'd set up massive services to support that. But because the effects of brain injury are invisible, we don't see the injury on the outside, then we skip it, and we often put it down to other issues as well. So if I've had a brain injury that affects my frontal lobes, my decision-making is going to be poor. If I have a brain injury that affects my speech might become slurred, my memory might become affected, all things that would be easily attributable to substance misuse, alcohol misuse, rather than going, hold on a minute, maybe there's something else here going on that we need to have a little think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess moving on from that, it would be interesting to understand kind of for frontline workers, what are the indicators that someone might have firstly kind of experienced a traumatic brain injury, and how might that impact their ability to cope with day-to-day life?
Okay, so traumatic brain injuries are often frontal, not always, but often you'll see frontal type presentations. By that I mean the frontal lobes are the epicenter of the control center of the way we experience life. So anything we do gets controlled largely by the frontal lobes. So if I decide to have a conversation with you, every thought that I'm having is being processed by my frontal lobes. I'll think, do I want to say it in this way? Do I not want to say it in this way? How am I going to express myself? If I decide to close my door because I'm easily distractible, then that enables me to engage in this conversation. if my frontal lobes are impaired, I'm just going to say whatever comes into my mind, my inhibition, my ability to stop myself saying things, my ability to stay on track are going to be affected. Again, these are patterns that you see when people have a chaotic lifestyle or they have drug or alcohol misuse problems. So it's important to just watch for the potential crossover. So your biggies are frontal executive difficulties, memory difficulties, insight problems. By insight, I mean what you say about me might be quite different to what I say about me. And if I say, oh yeah, I'm fine with cooking, I'm fine with managing my money, and you go, hold on a minute, you eat terribly, I've never seen you cook a meal, and when you say you are cooking, what you're actually doing is often burning some toast or microwaving something, and that's as far as it goes. And when it comes to managing your money, I know that you get £250 of benefits and you draw it all out and you spend it all and you can't do the numbers when you're in the shop. You struggle with those things. That's an insight issue often. So what you see versus what I experience can be two different things. So we're looking at executive problems, memory problems, insight issues, and also personality changes, because some of the neurological conditions we see would be progressive. So if I'm drinking alcohol for a long period of time, then gradually that's going to poison my brain. It's going to cause brain shrinkage and it's going to cause brain damage. And what that often will do is lead to things like personality changes, speech problems, word finding difficulties, mobility or visual problems. So it's watching for those changes over time as well. And for those of us that work in homelessness over a period of time, we tend to see the same people hanging around the systems for a very long time. So we get to know people and we get to pick up on deterioration and notice changes. And it's important to be aware of that and pay attention to it, get people reviewed where possible.
Yeah, you can see how often the signs can go sort of, I guess, dismissed a lot, because people will say, you know, oh, that person is using substances and that explains their behaviour. And I think that must be a real challenge for frontline workers to know when to think, oh, actually, maybe this person has had a traumatic brain injury, or, you know, there is a learning disability. And actually, that distinction must be really difficult for frontline workers.
Absolutely, Jo. And nearly all of the referrals we get are come from support workers, nearly all of them. And they are rarely wrong. When you've worked in this field, you develop an instinct, you develop an understanding of thinking, hold on a minute, something's just not quite right here. There's something that's not explainable by the pattern that I've been told and what I'm seeing before me. If I give you an example, just started an assessment just recently with a lady where the support worker was saying, I think there might be a learning disability here that we don't know about. There's nothing on the records. Social services said there was nothing on their record to indicate learning disability. But you said, well, actually, no, there's something not quite as it seems here. And it's that sort of thing that as a support worker, you can do and you can feel, you can get a sense of. And if you trust your instincts, even if you might be wrong, and you go to somebody who specialises in that area, you've then got a chance to say, well, at least we've looked now. What I've heard people say in the past is that our population falls between the cracks. And I heard a guy speaking at a conference a little while ago, and he said, we don't fall between the cracks. You guys create cracks to force us between. And it was such a powerful metaphor for me that it's made me think that support workers and people who work with the homeless population on the daily, they don't do that. We go, hold on, let's seal up these cracks. Let's make sure we find ways to support people into services, into provisions. And with that lady that I just referred to there, with the help of the support worker, we did a little bit of research, and it turned out that she went to a residential school for children with special educational needs decades ago. That school's closed down now, and so people hadn't heard of it. I'm about to do some assessment with her, but it is quite clear that she does have a learning disability. And now she's been known to services in Liverpool for, I think, the best part of 10 years, and never been supported as somebody with a learning disability would be supported. Now, that's not because of lack of care from services or lack of care from the people around her. It's because nobody's ever really, until the support worker just now, asked that question and gone, let's do a proper look at this. Let's see exactly what's going on.
Yeah. Wow. I really like the metaphor about kind of not falling through the cracks. I think that's really, really, really powerful. I wanted to kind of think about also kind of alcohol-related brain damage and think about kind of the differences in, I guess, signs that frontline workers might look out for, and also kind of what is the link between alcohol-related brain damage and homelessness and kind of the prevalence of that?
Okay, so the links are huge. The lower you fall down the socioeconomic status scale, so the poorer you are essentially, the more likely you are to get alcohol-related brain damage. That's public health figures would show you that. Percentages are debatable, but high enough to say that you need specialised service and care. Now, when it comes to the causes of ARBD, then the more vulnerable your brain is to damage, the more vulnerable your brain is to alcohol-related brain damage. So if you have a history of head injury, for example, if you have been marginalised from education, then if your brain will be susceptible to alcohol-related brain damage. Then if you have poor diet and you have high alcohol intake, what you get is the toxic effect of the alcohol. You get the impact of the alcohol on other organs like your liver. You get thiamine deficiency. You get dehydration, which does cause brain shrinkage. And you get the potential risks of alcohol-related brain damage from all of that combined. Roughly 35% of dependent drinkers will have cognitive deficits as a consequence of alcohol. Now, if you think about the population that we work with, that is very, very, very high. It's thought largely to affect men, particularly men in their middle and older ages. But I think that's because women with alcohol difficulties and psychological struggles in their presentation would not necessarily be thought of as having alcohol-related brain damage. So I think it's more likely that it's being missed than there's a massive gender-based difference. When you're looking at the effects of drinking, then in the acute phase, so right at the early stages, you get early toxic effects of drinking, which many of us will be familiar with, that dehydration, the headaches, the memory loss, the poor decision-making, all those kind of things. If you keep on going through that into heavy and long-term drinking, then you get what's considered a transient alcohol-related brain damage, so something that can be repaired if we dry out. Usually take about 3 to 4 months for the effects to reduce, sometimes disappear completely. Then if you carry on drinking and you don't have that period of abstinence, quite soon afterwards, you can get permanent damage as a consequence of alcohol-related brain damage. In the homeless population, there's been research done. So there was some research done in 2005 by Gilchrist and Morrison, which something is going on at a neurological level. And then you've got memory loss as well. So again, it's back to that key indicators, insight, memory problems, personality changes, and executive functioning difficulties. Korsakoff's, you see more of that short-term memory loss, so lots more very poor short-term memory. Again, that's one of the things you can start to see as a change in a person when you've known them for a little while. You can see personality changes as well and changes in decision-making. And also something that happens at this phase as well is you'll often see what we call confabulation, what people might think of as telling lies or telling stories. Now, that's because the brain is having memory problems, and rather than being able to say, I don't remember, at some point it's filling in those gaps with stories of its own. So it's not a deliberate, malicious lie. It's confabulation that's a consequence of neurological problems. So that's Wernicke's, Korsakoff's, both consequence of thiamine deficiency. Both occur through heavy drinking, and you see more pronounced difficulties the longer you drink for. Now, if you carry that forward and you keep on drinking, then you get irreversible alcohol dementia, toxic damage to the brain due to heavy alcohol use over a prolonged period of time. You see shrinkage in the frontal lobes and the cerebellum. So again, you're starting to see people with balance coordination problems. You're starting to see very pronounced executive functioning difficulties and personality changes. And often at this point, you start to see attentional problems and even more impulsivity. And again, Joe, it's really important to emphasize that the way this presentation looks is the way it look, where you look when you are drunk, when you're under the influence. And I think that's partly why things get missed, because we go, oh, well, you know, they drink a lot, they use substances, or this is just how it is, rather than saying, hold on, let's just double check. And there's no harm in double checking anything if it leads to a potential useful intervention.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so important to kind of raise awareness of this as well. And yeah, get encouraging frontline workers to be like, if you've got an inkling that there's something more going on here, like, take that forward, go and consult with a specialist. Don't just kind of accept that as this is the way that someone behaves because of XYZ. It's like, okay, let's explore this further. I think that's really key. I wanted to ask, you know, if someone has kind of got a neuropsychological need, what is the best way for someone to kind of support that individual? So in terms of their kind of ways of working with someone, you know, what changes do they need to make in terms of that support work?
So the first thing is getting it recognised, getting it acknowledged. Support workers are amazing advocates, but you've got to try and balance that with pragmatism. So you can't go all out, come on, get this sorted now. There's a real problem here, because you might be wrong. We've got to go gently, and we've got to go, okay, we want to check out if there is an issue here. Who are the best people to help us check this out? And usually it's via the GP. You'll get in touch with your homeless specialist GP or your other support systems and say, look, can we just check out if there's a neurological need here? And the way to do that is you look at the examples that I gave you before about the kind of things that people would struggle with, those insight, memory, personality, executive function difficulties. Log examples of them, write to the GP and say, can you do a neurological review or a neuropsychological review, because I'm seeing this pattern and we're worried about the person. And then once you've got that assessment done, hopefully you'll get a neuropsychological assessment or a neurological assessment where the person completing the assessment will say, oh yeah, we see difficulties with their frontal lobes, we see damage to the frontal lobes, or we see damage to the cerebellum. And what you want to do then through your advocacy role is say, okay, what do I do to help this in real life? Which is the question that you've just asked me there. What do we do to help? And it's hard to answer because it depends on the individual and what their profile is. So for example, working with somebody with quite significant attentional problems, they will need lots and lots of reminders. So a lady I'm working with at the moment gets a phone call in the morning to remind her to take her medication. Now that phone call comes before she's even out of bed. So by the time she's answered the phone, come round, gone to the toilet, got up, got herself dressed, she's forgotten completely, her attention's gone from what the phone call was about. So then she needs a second phone call to help that work, saying, have you taken your medication? No, I'm not taking my medication. Okay, I'm going to stay on the phone with you now until you've taken your medication. And we stay with the person to do that. We'll go in, and if they've got any form of accommodation, we'll look at how their accommodation can be changed to meet their neuropsychological profile. So for example, if I've got falling over or got mobility or visual difficulties, my flat or my hostel environment needs to be supportive of that. If I've got memory problems, we need cues in to help people remember things. And we want to try and create crutches, if you like, support systems that are commensurate with the difficulties that a person has. So for example, if I have memory problems and I'm going to miss appointments, I might want you as my support worker to begin by doing me a phone call or a message the night before my appointment, a message on the morning of the appointment, and then a message when I'm due to be leaving for the appointment. And then you go from there, you can tail that down to say, okay, the night before now, we're messaging or ringing and saying, can you write this on your phone? Or can you put this on a note somewhere as a reminder? Then the next morning we'll go, did you write on your note? Tell me what it says. So you're gradually leading the person towards having their own support systems in place that are not wholly reliant on other people, because staff change, people change, and we want people, want folk with the neurological struggle to be able to have systems in place that where if I go or the support worker goes, that system's still in place to support them.
Yeah. And like you said, it completely depends on each individual and kind of how they're presenting as to what that kind of support is going forward. But yeah, it's so useful to hear kind of the different examples of how you might be able to kind of adapt the ways of working. I guess we've already kind of looked at this point, but talking about kind of why people fall through the cracks in terms of accessing support, I don't know if we wanted to comment more on that in terms of, you know, there being very few services tailored to the homeless community in terms of kind of brain injury. So why is it that people are kind of not getting the support that they need?
Okay, so I think it's tricky. This is, the reality is this is a complex population to work with, and it's hard work. That is the truth. It is hard work to do this work. It's hard work to show constant compassion and care, and when you do, it burns you out. And as a result, I think because many of us go into this work because we care, we take on that advocacy role and we keep pushing and pushing, and we get moved out and moved on and burnt out. And so there's no real consistency over a long period of time. If you think about me in my family home, if I start to have changes over a period of time, people are going to notice. And so our population gets missed a lot of the time. And when it comes to the neuropsychological needs, then it's only really, I'd say, over the last, I don't know, maybe 30 years that we've started to really get a grasp on neuropsychology and how damaged the brain affects the way that we live our lives. And so it's really early. It's a baby in terms of discipline and study. And so there's that element of it too. And as I keep on saying, a lot of what we see, you can put down to something else. You can say it's a consequence of alcohol and drug misuse. Now, over the last, I don't know, maybe 5 to 8 years, we've seen a massive increase in neuro services for the homeless population. So the first thing to do is to find out whether there are any services like that in your area. And if there are, amazing. If there's not, then you want to try and find out how you can enable your client to access mainstream services. We can't be tolerating services saying we don't work with people who use substances. We've just got to do something about that. The number of times I've had learning disability services saying this isn't a learning disability, it's because of their alcohol use. And that's been a mistake. It's been incorrect, like with the case I told you before. That's part of our job is to go, hold on, can we just check? Can we just check? The number of times I say, can we just check? And we check and we find something a little bit different. The desire is there, the care is there, the capacity isn't at the moment. We all know services are struggling in terms of resources and capacity, and a lot of the times our population can become quite demanding in terms of service need, and that's no point shying away from that. But what we can do is, if we get the right kind of care over the medium to long term, we see a reduction in intensity of care needs. We've just got to take that long view, which again is hard when we've got high staff turnover and burnout because people aren't able to stay with this for the long term.
Yeah. I guess my final question is, I mean, it's a bit of a big one and I guess you've touched on it, but what do you think needs to happen to the healthcare system to enable kind of our clients to get the right support? Obviously, there's loads of reasons, you know, kind of financial, moral, social reasons why it needs to be tailored right. But it'd be interesting to hear your views.
So we need to work together. We've just got to work together. We can't say, as a psychologist, I can't work with this person on their mental health problems because they're using alcohol or drugs. We've got to stop doing that. We've got to say, okay, I'm going to struggle. The reality is I'm going to struggle to work with this person on their mental health difficulties because of that. Can you help me with that? And then we work together. As an example, we've got a lady working with at the moment who has been lost really to CMHT, the community mental health team, because of poor engagement. And the reason she has poor engagement is because she has huge levels of trauma and substance misuse. Now, what's happened is a harm reduction drugs worker has come in and started working with and focused on that, and also said to me, can you come and assess her cognitive difficulties? I'll come and assess her cognitive difficulties, then begin a little bit of work with her and with the drug worker, and the three of us begin work together. And from there, we then say, okay, now's the time. If I can get the CMHT to come back in, but work in a person-centered way. So instead of saying to them, don't ask her to come to you for an hour session, she's not going to come. Can you just come to her for a 10-minute session while she develops trust and develops consistency, because she's never failed to turn up to any of my appointments when I've gone to her and when I've kept the appointments short. So now we're tailoring services to meet the person's need, whilst also saying to the CMHT, we understand the demand, we get it. And then we do that, and the next stage then is we develop a shared understanding with the client and with services that we can then provide, from which though, so then we can provide support and training to the staff in the hostel that she works with. So then we've got a whole system thinking together and working together around the individual, rather than saying, I can't assess your neural presentation because you're using alcohol. I can't work on your mental health needs because you're using drugs. I can't work with you unless you come to me. So we've got to just think bigger. And we often think bigger means more money or more demand. It doesn't. The cost of a worker coming from a base to see this person for a 10-minute session is going to be no more than the cost of allocating a one-hour session where she's supposed to come to you and then doesn't turn up. And the long-term gains are huge. So it's all about collaboration, sharing responsibilities, sharing understanding, working together, and then we will see much more care and much better outcomes. We can't keep as well making conditions on people. You can't say, we'll only look after you if you stop doing this or if you do that. You know, I've got two kids, and I'd love to say to them, I'm only going to be around cooking your dinner if you do X, Y, and Z. But I can't, because I'm the dad and I care for them and I show that responsibility. And hopefully if one day it comes where I can't do things for myself, somebody will be there for me. Everybody that we work with, every homeless person that we work with has been somebody's child, somebody's relative, somebody's friend. We have to look at every single person we work with to say, okay, if this was me, if this was somebody who I love, what care would I want to give them? What care would I want to make sure I give them? We can do that in a way that still takes care of ourselves as well, because we've got to be there for the long run as well.
Yeah. Wow, that's really powerful. Thank you, Steve. Unfortunately, I think that's all we've got time for. But thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been so useful to understand more about kind of the neuropsychological needs of people experiencing homelessness and think about ways we can access support for these individuals. But yeah, thank you so much, Steve, for your time.
Thanks for listening. To keep up to date with the latest goings on at HomelessLink, please follow us on Twitter at HomelessLink. If you're interested in training and development opportunities for yourself, your team, or your organisation, get in touch by emailing training@homelesslink.org.uk. We have a range of courses that help staff and organisations develop the skills needed to tackle current issues and improve services.